You're just so sad. Why? Oh, because I've been bullied my whole life because I can fly.
Yeah, exactly. Just leave, dude. Just leave. You can't because the sunlight.
It's so bright.
Leave in the middle of the night. Live from the Mundangerous City Warrens in New York City, I'm your host Shane.
And I'm your host Ishan.
And welcome to episode 260 of Total Party Thrill, a podcast for game masters and players where we discuss our campaigns in order to inspire yours.
In this episode, we're continuing our series on playing non-human characters and talking about kobolds. But first, the party finds old gear in the Gates of Morning campaign. And later, the weather balloon surveys the scene in the Character Creation Forge.
Leave behind the safety of the Humblewood and travel down the Tarngrip coast to the Bay of Baloosh, home to both the Kingdom of Den and the Serpent Domain. But neither hold the true power of the Bay, for that lies in the sea itself and the pirate lords that call her tides their home. The dread pirate Captain Bluebeak, Tiberius Fang, Kin the Bladeless, and Gabrielle LaFleur, the self-proclaimed pirate queen. Each one vying for power over the very tides themselves. But do any of them really have what it takes to hold up the legacy of the Briny Bulldog? Tune in each week to find out if our little crew has what it takes to stand up to the pirates of the blood-soaked waters. Dark Fortunes is available every Monday on iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play. Set sail for high seas adventure.
So, Shane, I had to do some research here, but it turns out in just a couple weeks, we turn 5 years old.
That's terrifying. What happened to us?
We got old.
A few more gray hairs.
I have many, many more gray hairs. I don't know what you're talking about. I fully expected we would have gotten tired of this years ago and moved on to something, I don't know, worse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, something definitely lower effort.
But since we are here, it's time for a mailbag. So send in your questions. You've probably got about a week and a half before we record that episode. So do it quickly, I guess.
Yep. Put a mailbag question in the subject line so we can find it. That will help us a lot. And yeah, we will get through as many of those as we can in kind of our usual rapid fire order.
And then some other, you know, dumb bullshit.
Exactly. So Ishan, I have a bone to pick.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah. That's
I have
what we're
a bone
here for.
With Superman and Geralt of Rivia, Mr. Henry Cavill has adopted every single one of my hobbies, video games, weightlifting, Warhammer, and now building computers, and he's doing them all better than me.
Yeah, I mean, that's the reason that you're upset. At first, you were like, oh my God, Henry Cavill does the same stuff as me. And then you realized he is much better at it.
He's just the better version of me. Yeah, but I still have a podcast. Fuck you, Henry Cavill.
Why did you jinx it? He's now going to start a gaming podcast. Of course he's going to. What else is he going to do? He can't film.
I'm angling for a spot on his podcast. Make the Henry Cavill beef real. yeah, no, but he took over Instagram, apparently, building his PC in his like kitchen with his grandma blinds, and it was very heartwarming. And then like literally 2 days later, the last of my components came in and I had to build my computer and I was going to stream it. And then I just felt bad because he had already done better than I'll ever do.
You just need to edit it heavily, like happens to this podcast.
Right. Anyway, it took me like 5 hours because I had some trouble with RGB wiring routing, and it drove me nuts. It would have been a very boring stream of a grown man staring at a group of wires and going, I think these could fit better.
I don't understand anything of what you just said, but, you know, just take out the part where you put in something upside down. It's like cooking videos on Instagram where, you know, it's 7 stories lined up and each one is 8 seconds long and voila, risotto.
Yeah, well, that's a 90-minute risotto recipe, sir. Don't lie to me. Yeah, it's like adult Legos.
So Legos,
yeah, except with, I guess, with like high-powered computer components.
Wait, is your computer water-cooled?
It is.
That's a good thing, right?
depends.
It's all in the where the water is.
If it doesn't leak, it's great.
Well, you know, I'm glad you have a high-powered computer so that you can run all our fancy podcasting equipment to bring to you the great audio on this. After 5 years, you deserve it.
I'm looking forward to this for editing video, because it used to take me like 8 hours to render a video for YouTube, and now I can actually do that in like 8 minutes because it's only like, you know, 25-minute videos that we ever do, assuming we ever actually see each other again.
I mean, we still haven't figured out how we're going to do unboxing videos yet. I think it might be lots of cuts and then merging two videos shot a week apart, and we just have to act surprised.
Oh yeah, that's how it has to work. Is like one of us will unbox it and then the other will watch the unboxing with the box in their hands and film their reaction to the unboxing. And then we'll cut it all together using magic.
We'll just need to solicit two copies of everything.
Great. We're already on the outs with a lot of publishers.
All publishers.
Beetle and Grimms has always done well by us, so thank you to Jason, who's our contact there. They've always hooked us up. So
they're great. That's due to no fault of our own. I don't know why they like us so much.
All right, well, while we're pondering the mysteries of the universe, where are we in the Gates of Morning campaign?
So the Gates of Morning campaign is our 5th edition D&D game set in Eberron, a sequel of sorts to the original Morning Glory campaign. And in southern Karnath, on the edge of the Mornland, the party is chasing a killer. So they've all returned to the place where they met 4 years ago for the very first time, headed toward a spot that Ephraim D'Orion marked on his map. And after taking shelter from the rain beneath a familiar outcropping of rock, everything goes dark. Only Zan's devil sight can pierce the darkness, and he can see two halflings in robes in the distance who fire bolts of energy at them.
So, per usual, Warden wild shapes, this time into a huge stag to provide some cover for the spellcasters, while Vesicod casts haste on Switch and Zan.
I think this is one of the first times where Warden specifically was like, I'll turn into something giant with a lot of hit points. Because that's the most useful thing right now.
That's all he ever did. He was the tank. Not by choice. Never by choice. Nobody cared about Warden's pain.
It's all fake meat.
Right. So Bramble dispels the darkness and calls out tactical orders, allowing the frontliners to close into melee range and strike severe blows against these shocked halflings.
But another undead amalgam creature appears in a deadly cloud of darkness, right in the middle of the back line. It slashes at Vesicod with spear-like hands made of bone, and then other spheres of darkness begin to litter the field of battle, and since Zan is the only one who can see through them, he has to begin calling out enemy locations to all of his blinded companions.
So Warden the Stag charges the halfling, gores it, and then Zan cuts it down with a conjured glaive, Switch guts the other one, and we've got one amalgamation left.
Although, from atop the ridge, yet one more halfling begins darkening the battlefield, and it starts lobbing missiles of ice right into Bramble's chest. Warden then summons a wall of fire, snakes it right up the side of the cliff, and then scorches both the undead monster and the halfling, who seems to be shouting orders in a language none of them understand.
Malan pelo al kelo esen!
Zan needs to close the distance, so he attempts to race up the ridge, but his foot catches on something buried in the dirt, and he lands face first. The undead monster then spears Vesicod through the side, who falls unconscious.
And of course, the haste that he cast fails, and Switch and Zan falter, robbed of the ability to move as the magic fades away from their bodies. Things are looking kind of grim. So Bramble races up to Vesicod and heals him with a touch. The Kalashtar opens his eyes while he's still on the ground, looks over to see the halfling on the ridge, casts a spell at him, and paralyzes him. But a surge of wild psionic energy that Vesicod is unable to keep control of actually turns out pretty good and arcs lightning into both the halfling and the undead creature.
Once again able to move, Zan then looks down to see what tripped him and unearths a large backpack, two small metal spheres, and a metal staff.
And everyone suddenly recalls what this is as recognition hits them. They remember the Day of Mourning 4 years ago, when the Ondarians, Bok and Morgana, emptied their satchels in this very location, hoping to salvage some equipment that might be useful in their desperate escape across no man's land. An experimental rev pack, 2 Dele grenades, and a siege staff of magic missile.
So, snatching one of those grenades, Zan lobs it into the air where it explodes in a huge sphere of dazzling daylight. The magical shadows fall away, and the undead monster howls in apparent pain.
But the creature does teleport one more time, directly next to Vesicod, although this time it isn't shrouded in darkness, and it spears him again. The Kalishtar falls and lies motionless, and it howls once more, this time in triumph. A red mist begins pouring from Vesicod's body. It thickens into crimson beads that gather inside the undead creature's mouth. It inhales all of it, leaving Vesicod a pale, dead corpse.
Meanwhile, Zan charges the halfling, slicing him into 2 halves that plummet to the bottom of the cliff, and Switch runs through the distracted undead. Its body withers and melts, leaving a thick pile of charred goo and a bladder-like sac filled with the blood of an entire person.
And we'll find out what happens next week.
So this week, Ishan, we're talking about kobolds.
It's the creature you love to hate. Or hate to love, I don't know. I feel like both of us, like some of our favorite NPCs are kobolds.
Look, the only redeeming thing about kobolds is they have a pretty good press.
I agree.
This episode is actually sponsored by Kobold Press. We didn't line this up on purpose. They just advertised on this episode for us. So great luck.
Look, we'll get into our favorite NPCs later. But okay, so kobolds. They are a low-level cannon fodder in most campaigns. You know, they're the ones that you kill because they have like 1 to 2 hit points before you actually fight goblins, because goblins can actually be dangerous.
Yeah, these are your tiny lizard dog creatures that, like, depending on your cannon, kind of shift a bit. They live in their underground warrens. They steal from people on the surface. They're known as, like, tunnelers and trap makers.
Yeah, they like yap and bark. I always, for some reason, picture them as like the dark ones from Diablo, the Diablo series.
Yeah, that seems reasonable.
However, kobolds are surprisingly vicious when they're cornered. They also have an affinity for arcane magic, and they can make endearing companions as long as they don't try to eat you while you're sleeping. I mean, sometimes they're more endearing because they're trying to eat you while you're sleeping.
Yeah, like most pets, the thrill of ownership is in the fact that they might eat you. Carol Baskin.
Look, I never owned Deacon, okay? He was his own person, if a little misguided.
In a way, he owned me.
He, like Meepo, owns my heart.
So what's the history of kobolds?
So the name comes from a sprite in Germanic folklore, but other than that, it really has nothing to do with the mythology. They're really a Dungeons & Dragons monster. And they were one of the original monsters in the 1974 White Box, although back then they were considered a type of goblinoid, and they just existed because they were easier to kill than orcs. And they were basically just like dog people. In a lot of other media that's sort of inspired by early D&D, they still look a lot like dogs. Mm-hmm. If they show up in anime, often they'll be dogs, and you know, they have like sort of like long dog-like snouts.
Like snouts, yeah. And they, like, sometimes they have like a the fur hanging off the chin kind of look, rather than like the more draconic like scales.
Yeah. Furries, not scalies.
Right. I think in some of like the joke games that kind of came out of D&D, like the dog kobold got really highlighted. Like
Kobolds Ate My Baby?
Yeah, Kobolds Ate My Baby, I think. They're the dog kobolds.
Then they showed up in the first E-Monster manual back in 1977, but they really didn't start to get developed as a monster with personality traits until the 1980s. Because in 1987, we got Tucker's Kobolds.
Yeah, one of the most harmful stories in the history of adversarial GMing. Tucker, the alleged source of this story, decided to make his kobolds behave like Navy SEALs and decimated a higher level adventuring party who underestimated them.
Yeah, I mean, it's an adventure you can still find out there, and it is extremely difficult, even if you're high level. I mean, this is sort of one of the examples of monsters played to their natural advantages, but also sort of played by someone who understands the mechanics of the game a little too well.
Right. Like, it's monsters playing their natural advantages with none of their natural, like, instinct, right? Like, none of their demonstrated capability in any fiction.
However, this sort of was an exercise in taking a monster that everyone kind of laughed at, that was sort of ridiculous and boring, and turning it into something interesting based on some of the lore that was written about them. You know, they're trap makers and they live in tunnels.
Right.
The point was to say, all right, they probably make tunnels that are too small for everybody else, but they can still maneuver easily. And the traps, like a properly concealed pit trap with spikes at the bottom, is still extremely deadly if you don't fly.
Right.
So however you might feel about Tucker's kobolds, it did spark more interest in them as a monster that you could use in different ways.
So I feel worse about it now.
Yeah.
I felt bad. Now I feel worse.
So in 1989, they appeared as a player race in Dragon Magazine, and then officially in a book as a player race in Skills and Powers in 1995.
We also got winged kobolds at that point, which is crazy to me. Those are just miniature dragons.
That's what they would tell you.
Right. Then by third edition, the race took on the now familiar lizard appearance. They had draconic ancestry, or at least draconic worship, and they've kind of kept that ever since.
Yeah, so fourth and fifth edition basically have kept the same lore.
All right, so what are some reasons to play kobolds?
I think probably the biggest one is you want to be underestimated. You want people to think you're not very good at what you do. You can play that up and then surprise people when, you know, you actually succeed at something.
You might also want a growth arc, you know, from small and lowly to high and mighty. Can't get too much lower than kobolds.
Yeah, like already as a first level character, you're not very good at stuff. But like a first level kobold is, you know, sniveling and grovelly and cowardly and terrified. But like the differences in power between racial archetypes, especially in like 5e, by the time you get to 17th level, matter none. It might also be that you want a mechanical challenge. Kobolds these days are, well, at least in 5th edition, one of the few creatures that actually gets a penalty to a stat. Their abilities, some of them are good, but they also have quite a few negative ones. So you're sort of starting from a deficit if you're playing a kobold.
You also probably have a similar deficit if you want to roleplay a kobold. They are, you know, as mentioned, a race that doesn't get a lot of respect. And even in the fiction, like, kobolds are not really given any, not expected to have any agency. They're not really treated as, like, you know, thoughtful or, you know, considerate companions. They don't really rank in the order of the races. You know, they're just a small pest. So you're going to face that kind of scrutiny in whatever you do from people who don't understand who you are and what you're capable of.
Yeah, I like the niche that they kind of occupy. Like, they're not, you know, a typical player race, but they're not like a goblin where you have a lot of people in game who might say, we have to exterminate it immediately because they're like a threat to society. They're more like, oh, it's a giant rat person and that's kind of gross. And like, should we exterminate it? I don't know. I kind of think it's kind of cute.
Yeah. I think also like people understand the ascension of goblins. Like when goblinoids become super powerful, it's like, oh, well, that's not normal, but like, yeah, sure, of course, we get that. Nobody sees that for kobolds, right? Like,
yeah, kobolds, you get a lot of condescension.
Yeah, you're like, you're kobold shaman, okay, you know a couple spells, that's cute. Like, go back to worshiping your, you know, ancient red dragon who doesn't respect that you exist.
Right. And then you get to be like, okay, cool, I cast Cone of Cold.
Yeah.
And then you could lean into the trap-making ability of kobolds. You might want to tinker with probably absurd traps. They're probably not, you know, the competent ranger hunter who's like laying down a snare or a bear trap. It's some sort of insane Rube Goldberg contraption. Probably not steam power, probably like rickety and made of like rocks and stuff, but still very deadly.
It's like Ewok traps.
Perfect, exactly. Oh my God, kobolds are the Ewoks of D&D.
Oh, the little teddy bears.
Who eat people?
All right, so let's talk a little bit about their physiology. As you mentioned, they do have a penalty. So they have +2 dex and -2 strength, meaning they are weaker than average, but slightly more dexterous.
Yeah, kobolds know that they're fragile and that they're easy to pick on and that other creatures will do it if they can. So as as a society, kobolds tend to be easily cowed. Keep in mind, though, like anytime we're talking about what a kobold may or may not do, that's sort of as a rule. Your kobold, though, that you are playing, whether an NPC or a PC, you know, decide how they fit in. Are they a typical kobold? Do they go against the grain? You know, where do you fit in kobold society, and how do you relate to other kinds of kobolds?
They're also size small, which may be stretching it a little bit. They have dark vision, which makes them naturally home underground.
Yeah, small also means that you can't use heavy weapons, so that limits a fair number of your weapon possibilities. You know, no longbows, etc., even though you've got a plus two dex. And then you get grovel, cower, and beg. As an action, you can basically fall to your knees and start whimpering. And this distracts all enemies within 10 feet enough that all your allies will get advantage against them for a round. It's a good ability. It just really requires you to sacrifice your in-game dignity to use it, which is a little strange that like there's such an RP penalty attached to something mechanical.
I think it's interesting, like a kobold assassin would absolutely use that and then like grin devilishly after it works, right? Like the constantly being underestimated thing. But I agree, like it's going to feel gross if you're trying to be like the brave heroic kobold and you're like, okay, I guess I'll just play into my racial stereotype. Don't kill me, please, please, please.
Right. I mean, you know, I guess it's like, all right, let's do get help. No, I hate get help.
Yeah.
You can, though, reflavor this, right? Like, mechanically, all it does is you distract people so that everyone else gets advantage. I mean, it could be a flashy display or something if you wanted to be some sort of swashbuckler kobold. You do get pack tactics, though, which is great. You get advantage on attack rolls against any enemy who is adjacent to an ally of yours, which makes you a great rogue. It also makes you great at just attacking in general as long as you're with a party. But of course, like, why would you not have a party?
Right. Yeah, this is D&D.
Also, you're a kobold. But remember, like that influences the way that you think about things, right? Kobolds have strength in numbers. When they are an enemy that is fighting the party, they use pack tactics to gang up. When you are a kobold PC, you're used to working in a group collectively. You know, how does that influence the way that you view your allies? How does that influence the way that you view yourself and your rank in this party and like where you fit in?
I mean, I do think that opens up a lot of like not even necessarily like playing against type possibilities for like your battle master or like some of the like more leader like bard abilities where like, you know, you're used to fighting with a group. This is a group of individuals that need to come together as a unit. Like you see battle from that perspective of not individual force, but collective force. Like it makes sense that you would encourage those types of things.
Right, and then you'd get an advantage from it.
Right.
Of course, you also get sunlight sensitivity, which...
Gotta stay underground.
Yeah, it sucks. You get disadvantage on perception checks and attack rolls while you're in direct sunlight. However, the book doesn't define exactly what direct sunlight means, so you're gonna have to talk to your GM.
So stick to forests, I guess.
Right. Light foliage. I think it's kind of cloudy today. I think that's fine, right? I'm wearing a hood. That's not direct sunlight.
Find yourself a fedora and just, you know, Indiana Jones your way through D&D and it'll be fine. Like, DMs, give your kobold players magic fedoras.
That's what Jarl Axel does, right? Like, drow have the same problem. That's why wide brim hat, big old plumage in it. It's not because it looks good, although it looks good. It's,
right.
It's to keep the sun out of my eyes.
I imagine drow in 10-gallon hats.
Yeah, but, you know, after 10 minutes in sunlight, they dissolve.
Right.
Oh no, my Pawafwi.
Jesus, not this again. All right, languages. You get common and draconic. I think that's the only player race that starts with draconic as a standard language. So that's an interesting thing, though obviously lots of people can just take it.
Yeah, although you need a reason. Like it's not one of the normal ones that you can pick, at least according to Raw, although, you know, most people just go ahead and say you can pick Celestial or whatever you want. But like technically, it's tough to get Draconic unless you were specifically given Draconic or can pick any language. So it can be an interesting RP point if like randomly the kobold that has no official schooling, you know, halfway through the adventure is like, oh yeah, I speak Draconic. Course. Yeah, I can read that.
What? Yeah, I can read that. Those runes? Yeah, they say I prepared explosive runes this morning.
Dummy. Now, they're also reptilian, although they have some dog-like features. And this plays a big role into their physiology. I think probably more than most races that you can play as a PC, they differ from the norm. So they're cold-blooded. Unlike dragons, which are warm-blooded, if it gets too cold, you probably get kind of sleepy. You prefer warm climates. You gotta bundle up. Like, it's not good for you to be out in the snow.
Yeah, you're going to need to trade that fedora for a parka if it dips below 60.
Maybe you need some fire magic just to stay warm.
Right.
You are scaled, and your scales have different patterns and also different colorings depending on the tribe in your lineage. It could be because of the particular dragon that your tribe feels like you're descended from. You know, maybe you have red scales or blue scales or whatever. And then you can also have striations and patterns, and often those will have some sort of like heraldic meaning.
Then they are also omnivorous. I think they're notable for stealing the eggs of other creatures, but they will pretty much eat anything because I think they get portrayed as hunters to a small degree, but often they're more scavengers, right?
Yeah, so like they'll eat dead things. That's fine. If they defeat you in combat and nobody comes to claim your corpse, they'll probably eat your corpse. Like, why waste it?
Yeah.
You know, but they don't usually actively go out and try to kill people in order to eat them. Just, you know, they've died here.
Just if you happen to fall into one of our traps, we'll collect you.
It wasn't personal. They also lay eggs. This will be a little more important later when it comes to gender roles, because kobolds don't really have gender roles because females just lay eggs and then you get back to work.
Right. And they can also change sex, which is a weird little like tidbit to amphibian like DNA
right,
Jurassic
it's
Park,
it's
right?
The Jurassic Park frog thing.
Right.
I think it's new in 5th edition. It's like, hey, if, you know, too many of one sex or the other in the tribe gets killed off or whatever, then some of them will just slowly switch. It's not portrayed as a conscious thing, but it easily could be. And I think, you know, it's a pretty, like, canon way to say that I have a kobold that, you know, was born as one sex and has since switched to another for whatever reason you want.
Yeah, I think what makes that interesting is how little of a deal that would be to a kobold and, like, how little you would even necessarily want to highlight it. Though it can mean that, like, you know, it doesn't have to mean that your gender identity changes at all, of course.
Right.
Right. Like, sure, like, there's not enough male kobolds here, so I have to be a male kobold for a while or whatever, right? Because that's just physiology. But like, it doesn't change who you are or what you do in the party. It's just a weird quirk of your physiology.
And just kobolds in general, we'll get more into this in society, but just have less delineation between gender identity, gender roles, things like that, because it just starts off not mattering.
And then their lifespan is up to 120 years, which I gotta imagine is natural lifespan.
On a farm.
I'm gonna put that at about 25.
But consider this. Most kobolds die young just because it's a dangerous life. Things eat them. Medicine isn't great. But you could live up to 120 years. That's so much wasted time. You know, do kobolds even know that you can live that long?
Almost certainly not.
And then if you find out, that would probably piss you off. And then if you actually did live that long, if you got to like 100 years as a kobold, who knows what you could be capable of? What kind of magic could you learn? Also, I think it's called out in a few places that kobolds don't really worry with like medicine and healing because they're just so weak that one hit kills all of them.
They're a race that like internalizes the need for group survival over individual survival, right? Like they just kind of inherently understand that in their packs. It's important.
Right. And you can, one female, I think, can lay up to 6 eggs a year. So you're just, you know, you mate, lay an egg 2 weeks later, move on. But that means that you're always replenishing the supply of new kobolds. And then, like we mentioned before, there are the Urds, the winged kobolds, who are sort of like related to a slightly different god, and so strangely get treated poorly by other kobolds.
I could not care about this drama any less. I did not know that they had an actual name, though.
I like the idea that you're just so sad. Why? Oh, because I've been bullied my whole life because I can fly.
Yeah, exactly. Just leave, dude. Just leave. You can't because the sunlight.
So bright.
Leave in the middle of the night. All right, let's run through some cultural touchstones for kobolds.
So in current incarnations, kobolds believe that they are distant descendants of dragons, which is, you know, why they're reptilian, why they have scales and things like that. And they display personality traits like you might get from a tiny little dragon, or I don't know, maybe cats, actually.
Yeah. So they're dragon-like, dog-like, and now cat-like.
So they're covetous. They're very curious. They definitely can be very intelligent. But because they are small and weak and they know it, they are very cowardly.
And then this, of course, manifests itself in their broader culture. So they are insular. They try to remain hidden. They steal occasionally, but prefer to just run and hide rather than fight. They will lead you into traps rather than, you know, fighting you outright. There's no concept of honor or anything like that.
Yeah, think about this when you're running kobolds. You know, what is the optimal way, not necessarily to defeat the party, right? Which is sort of the mistake Tucker's kobolds makes. But what is the optimal way for the kobolds, well, the majority of them to stay alive?
Right.
And to, like, accomplish the goal that they set out, which is probably a very, like, modest goal.
Kobolds are probably more inclined to, like, capture powerful adventurers and, like, rob them, right? Like, if they can get away with it, like, I don't know that they would attempt to physically overpower anybody if they needed, unless they were, like, defending their home.
Right, unless you're like, hey, we're going to slaughter all of you, then, yeah, they get kind of vicious. But, yeah, in general, kobolds are going to be like, we tie you up and we take your shiny stuff. If we do try to slit your throats, then you might actually use your, you know, daily spells and kill us all.
Right.
So the god of the kobolds, Kurtulmak, was long ago trapped by Gond, the god of the gnomes. So kobolds hate gnomes, and divine magic is, at least some say, difficult for them to cast. In any case, divine kobolds are pretty rare.
I am coming around on kobolds. but the flip side is because of their draconic ancestry, arcane magic comes rather easily to kobolds. So sorcerers are super common. And then obviously in 5th edition, that will be your draconic bloodline.
The society is built around protection of the tribe, like we said. So they are accomplished at tunneling and trap making. All of that is in service to safety, to, you know, keeping other creatures away, because pretty much any creature a kobold meets, whether, you know, another sort of sapient species or a wild animal, can easily kill them.
So we've mentioned this, but of course, no distinct gender roles because of their whole egg laying and sex fluidity situation. You know, there's no reason to really define things on which parts you have, because that's transient.
I like the idea that a kobold adventurer is also confused by the gender roles in, like, a normal adventuring party, or gets very confused when, like, they go to town and, like, the human village is sort of, like, divided that way. And it's just like, I don't understand. I'm very confused. And half of you are wasting your time and the other half are, like, not getting paid. I don't get it. I also think it would be cool if, like, there's a biological change in a kobold's body where, like, if you had, let's say, a near TPK and half the party died, and then, you know, people bring in new characters and now the gender dynamic of the party is thrown off, the kobold's body is just like, oh, wait, hold on. There's not enough males. I'm switching. And it's just like, no, this is not weird. I don't know why you're weirded out by this.
It's mildly inconvenient at best when I shed my dong. Hashtag shed my dong.
Happens a few times a year. Minimum.
Another one of those classic cliches, kobolds tend to work in service of a dragon, like as a tribe, right? Which they will generally be worshiping the dragon as a god, or as at least like an ancestor, something to that degree. So like rabid devotion to dragons that they serve.
Yeah, to the point where some stories have kobolds like willingly jumping into a dragon's mouth as like an offering, I guess.
I don't know why a dragon would want to eat a mangy kobold, but okay.
Right. It tastes like dog.
Yeah.
Gross.
Which tastes like chicken.
All right. So let's talk about family ties. Kobolds have different kinds of family ties from, you know, your traditional player races. Eggs are raised communally by the entire tribe. So all family relationships are more like cousins. You won't necessarily know who, like, your direct line is tied to. Just, you know, everybody is vaguely related to everybody.
Bonded pairs are going to be rare. You won't see, like, you know, two parents or, you know, long time, like, matriarch and patriarch of a family. Like, none of that really happens. The family unit is really just the tribe.
Putting all this stuff together, I'm kind of feeling like, did 3rd through 5th edition D&D writers specifically want to make kobolds like sex positive and poly? Because they did.
I'm not ascribing any positive intent to anybody.
So instead of like a traditional family loyalty, a kobold is likely to be more loyal to their specific tribe as a whole, or to the dragon god that maybe their tribe worships.
All right, so let's talk about how kobolds interact with other groups, other people.
In terms of other members of your tribe, consider where you are in the hierarchy. What's your job? Every kobold has a job. Do you like it? Is there room for advancement in that job? Can you work your way up? Or maybe do you want to leave?
I think classically kobold adventurers feel like there's more out there for them.
Yeah, yeah.
How do you feel about other kobolds? As adventuring kobolds are very rare, so why are they out of their warren? Like, if you run into another adventuring kobold, something is up.
What tribe are they from? What's their coloration? What can you tell from their particular like scale pattern? Which dragon god does their tribe worship? Does your dragon god hate their dragon god?
Do you have a contest of trap making, or, you know, thievery or groveling? Like, do you have some kind of intertribal, measuring system that you have to obey or honor?
Right. I challenge you to a yip off. Only one of us can be the mascot of this party. And then other races. If you are venturing out into the wide world for the first time, at first you're likely timid and scared. This is that growth arc. I say, like, lean into it, play it up, you know, like, be terrified of the first gnome you ever see, right? Like the awful, horrible stories you've heard of gnomes and how they're like, they'll rip your entrails out with your teeth.
Mm-hmm.
And then find out that that's true. It's all true.
Right. But the other ones are mostly fine.
And if you're out here, you know, consider how you're proving yourself, because again, most people are underestimating you. Are you offering usefulness? Is it might? You've decided that you are actually going to be a very strong or tough kobold. Is it craftiness, because you are great at making traps? Do you impress everybody with your arcane prowess?
And then the question of gnomes, of course, how do you view them? Do you carry like a racial animosity towards them? Because gnomes probably don't feel strongly about you, or certainly don't feel any more strongly about you than any other race of or group of people will. You're just a kobold. Like, they definitely haven't internalized some animosity towards you because of something their deity did to your deity thousands of years ago that they don't even remember.
Right. I don't think about you at all.
Right. That's the classic Don Draper meme. I feel bad for you gnomes. All of your joy of and your worship of Garl Glittergold is just predicated on the abuse of kobolds. I don't think about you at all.
But I like the idea that a gnome and a kobold, like the kobold hates the gnome. The gnome's like, oh, well, this is bothersome.
Yeah,
but then they both bond over a love of insane steampunk technology.
Yeah. It's like the Artificer twins.
Right. What if we added poison spikes? And the gnome's like, oh my God, why didn't I think of that?
I like gnomes would be like steampunk, and your kobold artificer is going to be like wood punk.
Yeah. Oh, I carved this.
Yeah, I whittled this. It's poisonous.
You should touch it.
And then I think specifically as kobolds, you probably want to have a point of view on dragons. You know, do you fear them? Do you hold them in awe? Do you have like a hatred for enslaving groups of kobolds, like kind of religiously? Like, do you see them as a threat, or do you envy them? Like, what's your position on dragons? Because there's almost no doubt that as a kobold adventurer, you will eventually cross a dragon, especially if you have a decent DM who sees the obvious parallel. But like, I think the important thing is you don't have to be drawn into immediately like falling to your knees and worshiping, you know, the first young adult dragon you come across. Like, you can be, you might be defying the cultural norm of kobolds and maybe even what that dragon has seen before, because you are an adventurer. You have much more agency than the average kobold. You have grown to appreciate your own agency through this party.
Yeah, there's some definitely cool stories that are possible here. Being the kobold who strikes the final blow against the dragon. Great, now I have a new thing on my bucket list.
Yeah, Meepo the Dragon Slayer.
All right, so what are some reasons that a kobold might be out in the wide world?
Curiosity. You know, what's outside of these here warrens? What else is out there in the great big world?
My wings are just so ugly. You know, I had to get out here and see if I can find some way to get rid of them. This horrible curse.
If you want a more tragic backstory, maybe your tribe was wiped out. You were one of the lone or few survivors of a warren that no longer exists. You had no choice but to figure out what to do.
You have pack tactics. You need to find a pack.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you were kicked out. You didn't fit in for whatever reason. You climbed above your station, or you were less concerned with safety and more interested in, you know, seeing new and fascinating things.
You liked using daggers instead of spears, you know,
right.
like to kill them up close. It's too dangerous for a kobold. Get out of here.
You seem to really enjoy eating the enemies.
Yeah.
Maybe you want to become more powerful. You're tired of being weak and small and timid and scared, and instead you want to lord it over other people, or you just want to be able to defend yourself without worrying about it. Good way to do that is class levels.
Right. And then maybe you have like kind of taken the origin story to heart, right? And you want to find a way to free Kirtle Mac, or you have some prophecy of kobold ascension, something like that. Some, you know, story that motivates you to go out in the world to change it.
Yeah, I think that's a great backstory for like a kobold cleric. All right, so classes you're good at. Rogue, obviously. Anything with a dexterity. Monk is good because it doesn't matter that you're small. You hit as hard as any other monk.
Fighter, of course, is good. You have extra feats you can make up for your simple minus two. It, you know, at high level, a kobold fighter has the exact same stats as a regular fighter, except like one less useless feat that you keep forgetting to trigger.
Right, and just as many attacks.
Right.
You could be a ranger. You're at home in the wilderness tunnel or Underdark ranger. Sounds like a great fit.
Gloomstalker is like the perfect ranger for a kobold.
Oh, yeah.
who's, you know, capable of the agency of adventuring.
And then it doesn't really fit necessarily with your stats, but sorcerer, bard, warlock, any of those kinds of charisma-based casters really fit well with the arcane flavor, and then also the draconic ancestry. You can work that in anywhere. I think wizard probably makes a little bit less sense.
Yeah.
You can do it.
Yeah, I think the nice thing about the sorcerer and warlock especially is they have those sort of divine flavored origins as well, and that might make a lot more sense as a cleric of Kirtle Mac, or as a, you know, a priest of Kirtle Mac, rather than necessarily playing a cleric proper.
Oh yeah, I like the idea of Kirtle Mac's kind of a vestige, right? He's hard to communicate with, but he can still be a patron.
And then of course Artificer just fits too nicely with the whole, like, you know, fiddling and whittling and engineering and, you know, trap making, all of that sort of like tricksy behavior. You know, it's just a good fit. All of the flavor abilities for Artificer make a ton of sense, even if the mainline stats don't necessarily track for what you would expect.
So in combat, you're low strength, which makes it hard to wear heavy armor, and you can't use heavy weapons at all. So in general, range combat is probably your best bet, or, you know, a rogue or something that dashes in and out and, you know, makes best use of flanking and pack tactics.
Yeah, or something that gets its damage from beyond your weapon type is the important thing. You know, you can give up a D10, make that a D8, fine, that's one damage per round. But if you're adding your sneak attack damage, or you're adding, you know, extra attacks from monk or whatever, you can kind of neutralize that cost.
Yeah, and you can pretty reliably count on advantage. So, you know, you could even lean into like great weapon fighter, sharpshooter, things like that, and not have to worry that much about missing. But you are going to need a way to mitigate sunlight sensitivity. So you have to talk to your GM to figure out exactly what direct sunlight means.
Yeah, if you're not going to get a leg up from your GM, if they're not going to help you out, then you need to go for a spellcaster route that uses saving throws, because those won't be impacted by the penalties of sunlight sensitivity. You'll still be weaker, but at least your offensive capabilities won't be dependent on, you know, not having disadvantage because you happen to be in the sun today.
I mean, I guess you could say, but I have pack tactics, and so it all balances out, and I basically have nothing.
Yeah, right. On occasion, that's fine, right? Like, if you have the occasional direct sunlight fight every few sessions, and yeah, okay, you don't, you know, you just soak up the disadvantage and deal with it, it's not the end of the world. But if you're in an average campaign where, yeah, you're pretty much in direct sunlight for, you know, 30, 50% of your fights, like, that's gonna suck.
Yeah. A good way to do this is just, you know, you sort of theater of the minded, or say, like, tell me which way the sun's coming from. Okay, great. I stand over here on this side of the building.
Yeah.
You know, and then shoot from there.
Right. Tell me. Yeah, exactly. I'm within 5 feet of these shadows.
For skills, you can be good at acrobatics. Stealth is probably very good for you. Sleight of hand, because how else are you going to steal enough stuff to keep the Warren in potions and scrap?
And then thieves tools, which you can, of course, use to make traps and poisons and all types of underhanded things, as well as just, you know, picking locks and whatnot.
For magic items, I like gauntlets of ogre power or belts of giant strength, because you then just completely eliminate the stat penalty that you have. It just doesn't matter anymore.
I mean, it's great. And it frees you up to just boost your dex instead of worrying about strength.
Right. I mean, just dump it down to 6. Who cares?
Yep.
Drow gear can be good because that often eliminates sunlight sensitivity, because the drow are very concerned about that, but it works great for you too.
And then I think the most thematic stuff will be anything dragon related. You know, we talked about kobolds worshiping dragons as gods, but in the same way, like, any draconic themed item is going to be worshipped as an artifact, even if it is relatively common or low powered. You know, it would certainly be revered as, you know, of the greater race of our, you know, draconic overlords.
Yeah, and I think if you are like a kobold who's fascinated with dragons in a campaign, it's certainly fine for a GM or for you to talk to your GM and say, like, you know, eventually I would like to be able to use items that maybe only dragons can use, or, you know, whatever. Like, that's sort of a nice RP capstone for a character.
Yeah. So, Ishan, have you ever played a kobold?
Yes, but never as my primary character. So, for example, in Neverwinter Nights, the video game, you know, play a character, and then one of the NPCs you can pick up, which of course you also control, is Deacon, the kobold bard who I always made become a red dragon disciple.
Nice.
And then, you know, I've also been in games where you have hirelings and things like that, and like a kobold hireling is fun and interesting, but I've never played like just my character is a kobold, even though I always find them like fun and interesting and wacky.
So, yeah, I kind of feel like kobolds are on the edge of a little too goofy, or on the other side of it, they're kind of on the, like, too much old D&D cruft baggage, right? Mm. Like, the Tucker's kobold baggage, basically, right? Is like the, oh, yeah, no, they will murder everyone. Kobolds are untrustworthy and dangerous, and, like, I don't want to deal with that. And I also don't want to deal with, like, the Kender-esque, like, thievery and naivety that, like, makes you an annoying party member either. So, like, you got to kind of find that middle ground for the kobold, I feel like.
Yeah, like, I don't want to play the oh, boss, I'm so scared, please, like, don't kill me, you know, like, I guess that's okay for half a session, and then I'm not interested in doing that anymore.
Yeah, even when I played goblins, who, like, like, and accepting the, like, the canon of being bullied by hobgoblins as part of our characters, I still made them, like, brutal union toughs capable of dealing with what they needed to do.
But I'll say I've been leaning into gnomes more, who are just goofity. Like, that's their brand. And I'm definitely opening up to the point where I think I can do a good kobold and just make them silly, but also fun and useful.
Yeah, I think I would enjoy playing a kobold, and probably more than a gnome. But I haven't gone that far. Maybe someday, but today isn't that day. All right, do you hear that, Ishan?
It's a strange barking sound. I don't know why a reptile would bark, but here we are.
Well, it's time to move on to the Character Creation Forge and figure out what they're barking at. But first, let's talk about how our listeners can get in contact with us.
We do love hearing from you.
You can tweet at Shane at Mundangerous. That's M-U-N dangerous.
And you can tweet at Ishan at Evil Sans Carne. That's malice minus meat.
And you can tweet at the show at TPTcast.
You can also email us at TotalPartyThrill@gmail.com.
And you can find us on the web at www.TotalPartyThrill.com.
We're also on Facebook and Instagram at Total Party Thrill.
And join the conversation on Discord. There's a link in the show notes.
And get those mailbag questions to us so that we can get them into episode 262, our 5th anniversary.
All right. What do we have in the Character Creation Forge, Ishan?
We're building the weather balloon,
uh-huh.
which is a wacky kobold who flies above the action and rains down attacks and is also pretty good at covert reconnaissance.
Okay. All right. What's the build?
Alchemist Artificer 14, Pact of the Chain, Fey Warlock 3, Assassin Rogue 3.
Okay. So from Artificer.
So here's the conceit. A weather balloon, of course, has to fly. And one of the fastest ways to fly without starting like Aarakocra or something like that is our Alchemist Artificer, because at level 3, you can make an experimental elixir, one of which grants you a fly speed of 10 feet for 10 minutes with no concentration. And you can make additional ones with additional spell slots.
That is, okay, yeah, that's pretty hot air balloon speeds, isn't it?
Yes, it certainly is. I'm thinking of a kobold who's basically literally attaching balloons to a belt.
Uh-huh.
Or making like weird like wooden wings like the Urd they saw one time back at the Warren.
Okay, I dig it.
So Artificer will give you medium armor, shields, and con saves, which is going to be great for concentration checks. And spells like Death Ward, which is great if your wings fail for whatever reason, you plummet to the ground. Guidance, Absorb Elements, Featherfall, of course, very useful. Long Strider will double your fly speed.
20 feet, that's a stiff breeze.
Woo! And then Invisibility is great because if you are a flyer and invisible, that keeps people from shooting you out of the sky.
You will also get Thieves Tools, Tinker Tools, Alchemist Supplies, and another tool of your choice. So whatever it is that you need to do with your free time, you'll have the capability.
You get magical tinkering to, you know, light things up or make noises or things like that. You'll get up to 4 infused items. The important things here are at level 10, you can make winged boots, which means you are no longer dependent upon your experimental elixirs to fly. You can just fly for 4 hours a day, which is far more time than you need for regular combats. And then take a look at Eyes of the Eagle, which let you make perception checks normally at a very long distance, which is going to be a thing that will be useful because when you are a quarter mile up in the air, you're going to want to be able to see everything around you.
Yeah, that's your weather balloon sensor array. Then you'll have Right Tool for the Job, which will give you tool expertise as you need it.
And then you can make any set of tools that you have proficiency in over the course of a short rest.
You'll have Flash of Genius, which gives a bonus to a saving throw or ability check to you or an ally up to your intelligence mod times per day.
You'll get Spell Storing Item, which is nice because you can put an Artificer spell into it and it can get used a bunch of times per day. You can leave that with your party while you're up in the air so they can still make use of your spells, or you can use it on yourself, like make yourself invisible or things like that.
With Magic Item Adept, you'll have 5 items to attune to and no restrictions based on race or class or anything else. So you can grab those dragon-aligned items just fine.
Yeah. From Warlock, you'll get a Familiar, which will let you cast your touch spells within 100 feet. So even if you're way up in the air, you'll be able to heal the party and things like that with your Familiar. You, of course, will get Eldritch Blast. The invocations are important. Agonizing Blast, Eldritch Spear, which will give you a 300-foot Eldritch Blast, which means if you are 300 feet in the air, you can rain down Eldritch Blast, and unless somebody has a sharpshooter with a longbow, they are not going to be able to touch you. The other thing here is you get Misty Visions. That's an invocation that lets you cast Silent Image at will. Make a silent image of a cloud. And now, you're just a cloud. That's all you are, and it moves along with you, and you can change it to make it look like it's like billowing in the breeze, and then suddenly it fires Eldritch Blasts
right
from 300 feet in the air. The other thing is, the illusion will block line of sight. You'll be able to see through it and other people won't be, so you'll have advantage even if you don't already have pack tactics, and it should block direct sunlight. And then you can use a short rest to use those warlock slots to feed them into making more elixirs, because elixirs last until the end of your next short rest.
So then from Rogue, we will get 2 expertises. So, you know, your stealth, your probably sleight of hand, I think, is the most thematic, but perception could also be useful. You'll get some sneak attack dice, and you'll have cunning action, which will let you double your fly speed as a bonus action. And then you'll also get assassinate. So you can automatically crit on hits against surprise targets.
So the plan here is fly up in the air, turn into a cloud, wait until nobody suspects that the cloud is going to murder them, and then murder people.
Yeah, and if you're not able to figure out that piece of it, why don't you grab the spell sniper feat so you can also ignore cover and Eldritch Blast up to 600 feet away, effectively making you weather balloon borne artillery.
So for leveling order, go Artificer 4 to get that ASI or the spell sniper feat. Do all three of your warlock levels. Take Artificer to 10 so you get your winged boots. Take your rogue levels and then finish off Artificer.
All right. Before we wrap up, we want to take a moment and say thank you to our Patreon supporters.
Yeah, your support is what makes it possible for us to keep doing this show every single week. So if you'd like to learn more, you can check out all our rewards at patreon.com/totalpartythrill.
And you can also leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, which we will read on the air. And this one is a doozy. I'm not sure if this is a drag or,
or what?
A copy pasta or what, but we said we'd do it. So for the next 2 minutes, we're going to read this review.
This is Another Broken Build with No Name by Sub to Me on YT. Okay, so I'm creating a big boss for my campaign. This big boss relies on a lot of opportunity attacks. He has the Sentinel feat, the Mage Slayer feat, the Polon Master feat, and a reach weapon, a glaive. He's 18th level Bugbear Cavalier Fighter. The Cavalier's 18th level ability, though, it is so broken. Another character who I thought up is a Warforged Warlock 5, Rogue 9, Paladin 6, Celestial, Arcane Trickster, and Oath of Ancients.
He has a Defender Rapier, Finesse Weapon, 40 AC with Defensive Duelist, and 39 with Shield, +3 Plate Mail, and a +3 Shield, and a Defender Rapier using the bonus for AC +3, the Defensive Duelist feat, +6 to AC for one attack, the Shield of Faith spell, +1 for being Warforged, and he doesn't use Defensive Duelist, he can cast Shield instead. In addition to this, he has both a Cloak and Ring of Protection, which is +1 to AC for each item, +2 total. 5 third level spells, pack magic and multi-class spells, and sneak attack, divine smite, and the eldritch invocation, eldritch smite. You use all of these every round because the sneak attack is conditional but often comes into effect, and eldritch and divine smites can be used as long as you have a spell slot, which means you can stack them and use 2 of your 5 third level spells to do 48 radiant and 48 force and 5d6 sneak attack damage.
The best counter to this build is a spellcaster that has wisdom save spells, but even then, he has counterspell and can just use that. He also has 22 in both charisma and dexterity, using the manuals that buff your stats by 2, see the DMG. And even if the counterspell doesn't work, he has the resilient feat to get him proficiency in wisdom saves and the lucky feat. I rolled good stats. Even more broken, smiley emoji. Especially after I buff the AC by 8. This build is perfectly legal and doesn't break attunement rules. This is the most ridiculously OP build I've seen in 5e.
And on top of that, he has the narrative justification for his multiclassing. He was a criminal who took a job that ended badly. One of the gods saved him by making a deal with him. After a while, he grew to worship that goddess and became a paladin. Not at all OP.
I have not run all the numbers to see if this is definitely legal, but it feels like it.
Hey, and sub to me on YouTube. At Total Party Thrill.
Now that we've proved that we will read pretty much whatever you write in those 5-star reviews, send them on in.
Yeah, we got to put a time limit on this. All right, what do we have planned for next week's episode?
We're talking about random tables.
And in the Character Creation Forge?
We're building the lotto ticket.
Well, that's it for episode 260 of Total Party Thrill. I hope we lived up to our name, but either way, I'm Shane.
And I'm Ishan. Thanks for listening.
Total Party Thrill is brought to you this week by Cobalt Press.
See, we told you. Do you love the Creature Codex so much that you want to keep it close to your heart?
Yes.
Well, now you can.
How?
Well, you get all nearly 400 foes of the original Creature Codex for just half the price, $24.99, in a convenient and portable softcover version of the book.
Do you mean the Creature Codex Pocket Edition?
Oh, I do. I do indeed. The one I have right here with me always. I sleep with it.
The one that has great imaginative creatures like the Keg Golem, Shark Bull Ooze, Bar Brawl, Hierophant Lich, Wasteland Dragons, and hundreds more, all playtested and built by the industry's best designers?
Absolutely. I actually really like the Bar Brawl because it is a swarm creature that is a bar full of patrons who are having a fight.
Yeah. Navigate this, nerds.
So if that sounds cool, you can find out more at koboldpress.com.
And tell them DSPN sent you.